Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with an article in the Guardian Online newspaper, or news report, as you wish, which was run on Earth Day this past Monday, April 22nd. It is excerpted from a piece published jointly by the Columbia Journalism Review and The Nation magazine, which are sponsoring an April 30th conference aimed at reexamining the way journalists cover climate change. And the title is, Why is the U.S. Media So Bad at Covering Climate Change? Last summer, and it's by, I beg your pardon, the byline is by Kyle Pope and Mark Hertzgard. Last summer, during the deadliest wildfire season in California's history, MSNBC's Chris Hayes got into a revealing Twitter discussion about why U.S. television doesn't much cover climate change. Elon Green, an editor at Longform, had tweeted, "Sure would be nice if our news networks, the only outlets that can force change in this country, would cover it with commensurate urgency." Hayes, who is an editor at large for The Nation, replied that his program had tried, which was true. In 2016, All In with Chris Hayes spent an entire week highlighting the impact of climate change in the United States as part of a look at the issues that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were ignoring. The problem, Hayes tweeted, was that, quote, every single time we've covered climate change, it's been a palpable ratings killer, so the incentives are not great, unquote. The Twitter sphere pounced. TV used to be obligated to put on programming for the public good, even if it didn't get good ratings. What happened to that? Asked Thomas Albert. Gajaya said, "Your ratings killer argument against covering climate change is the reverse of that used during the 2016 primary, when corporate media justified gifting Trump $5 billion in free airtime because it was good for ratings, with disastrous results for The Nation," unquote. This spring, Hayes redeemed himself, airing perhaps the best coverage on American television yet of the Green New Deal. All In, his program, devoted its entire 29 March broadcast to analyzing the congressional resolution co-sponsored by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, which outlines a plan to mobilize the United States to stave off climate disaster and, in the process, create millions of green jobs. In a shrewd answer to the ratings challenge, Hayes booked Ocasio-Cortez, the most charismatic U.S. politician of the moment, for the entire hour. Yet, at a time when civilization is accelerating toward disaster, climate silence continues to reign across the bulk of the U.S. news media, especially on television, where most Americans still get their news. The brutal demands of ratings and money work against adequate coverage of the biggest story of our time. Many newspapers, too, are failing the climate test. Last October, the scientists of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released a landmark report warning that humanity had a mere 12 years to radically slash greenhouse gas emissions or face a calamitous future in which hundreds of millions of people worldwide would go hungry or homeless or worse. Only 22 of the 50 biggest newspapers in the United States covered that report. Instead of sleepwalking us toward disaster, the U.S. news media need to remember their Paul Revere responsibilities to awaken, inform, and rouse the people to action. To that end, The Nation and the Columbia Journalism Review are launching Covering Climate Change, a new playbook for a 1.5-degree world, a project aimed at dramatically improving U.S. media coverage of the climate crisis. When the IPCC scientists issued their 12-year warning, they said that limiting temperatures rise to 1.5 Celsius would require radically transforming energy, agriculture, transportation, construction, and other core sectors of the global economy. Our project is grounded in the conviction that the news sector must be transformed just as radically. The project will launch on 30 April with a conference at the Columbia Journalism School, a working forum where journalists will gather to start charting a new course. We envision this event as the beginning of a conversation that America's journalists and news organizations must have with one another, as well as with the public we are supposed to be serving, about how to cover this rapidly uncoiling emergency. Judging by the climate coverage to date, most of the U.S. news media still don't grasp the seriousness of this issue. There is a runaway train racing toward us, and its name is climate change. That is not alarmism. It is scientific fact. We as a civilization urgently need to slow that train down and help as many people off the tracks as possible. It's an enormous challenge, and if we don't get it right, nothing else will matter. The U.S. mainstream news media, unlike major news outlets in Europe and independent media in the U.S., have played a big part in getting it wrong for many years. It's past time to make amends. If 1.5 Celsius is the new limit for a habitable planet, how can newsrooms tell that story in ways that will finally resonate with their audiences? And given journalism's deeply troubled business model, how can such coverage be paid for? Some preliminary suggestions. Don't blame the audience and listen to the kids. The onus is on news organizations to craft the story in ways that will demand the attention of readers and viewers. The specifics of how to do this will vary depending on whether a given outlet works in text, radio, television, or some other medium, and whether it is commercially or publicly funded. But the core challenge is the same. A majority of Americans are interested in climate change and want to hear what can be done about it. This is especially true of the younger people that news organizations covet as an audience. Even most young Republicans want climate action. And no one is speaking with more clarity now than Greta Thunberg, Alexandria Villaseñor, and the other teenagers who have rallied hundreds of thousands of people into the streets worldwide for the school strike for climate demonstrations. Establish a diverse climate desk, but don't silo climate coverage. The climate story is too important and multidimensional for a news outlet not to have a designated team covering it. That team must have members who reflect the economic, racial, and gender diversity of America. If not, the coverage will miss crucial aspects of the story and fail to connect with important audiences. At the same time, climate change is so far-reaching that connections should be made when reporting on nearly every topic. For example, an economics reporter could partner with a climate reporter to cover the case for a just transition. The need to help workers and communities that have long relied on fossil fuel, such as the coal regions of Appalachia, transition to a clean energy economy as a Green New Deal envisions. Learn the science. Many journalists have long had a bias toward the conceptual. But you can't do justice to the climate crisis if you don't understand the scientific facts, in particular, how insanely late the hour is. At this point, anyone suggesting a leisurely approach to slashing emissions is not taking the science seriously. Make the time to get educated. Don't internalize the spin. Not only do most Americans care about climate change, but an overwhelming majority support a new Green Deal. 81% of registered voters said so as of last December, according to Yale climate pollsters. Trump and Fox don't like the Green New Deal. Fine. But journalists should report that the rest of America does. Likewise, they should not buy the argument that supporting a Green New Deal is a terrible political risk that will play into the hands of Trump and the GOP. Nor should the media give credence to wild assertions about what a Green New Deal would do or cost. The data simply does not support such accusations. But breaking free from this ideological trap requires another step. Help the heartland. Some of the places being hit hardest by climate change, such as the Midwestern states flooded this spring, have little access to real climate news. Instead, the denial peddled by Fox News and Rush Limbaugh dominates. Iconic TV newsman Bill Moyers has an antidote. Suppose you formed a consortium of media that could quickly act as a strike force to show how a disaster like this is related to climate change, not just for general media, but for agricultural media, heartland radio stations, local television outlets. A huge teachable moment could be at hand if there were a small coordinating nerve center of journalists who could energize reporting, op-eds, interviews, and so on that connect the public to the causes and not just the consequences of events like this. And that was Bill Moyers. And he added that such a team should, quote, always have on standby a pool of the most reputable scientists who, on camera and otherwise, can connect natural disasters to the latest and most credible scientific research. Cover the solutions. There isn't a more exciting time to be on the climate beat. That may sound strange considering how much suffering lies in store from the impacts that are already locked in. But with the Green New Deal, the U.S. government is now, for the first time, at least talking about a response that is commensurate with the scale and urgency of the problem. Reporters have a tendency to gravitate to the crime scene, to the tragedy. They have a harder time with the solutions to a problem. Some even mistake it as fluff. Now, with climate change, the solution is a critical part of the story. Don't be afraid to point fingers. As always, journalists should shun cheerleading, but neither should we be neutral. Diffusing the climate crisis is in everyone's interest, but some entities are resolutely opposed to doing what the science says is needed, starting with the President of the United States. The press has called out Trump on many fronts for his lying, corruption, and racism. But his deliberate worsening of the climate crisis has been little mentioned, though it is arguably the most consequential of his presidential actions. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil has announced plans to keep producing large amounts of oil and gas through at least 2040. Other companies have made similar declarations. If enacted, those plans guarantee catastrophe. Journalism has a responsibility to make that consequence clear to the public and to cover the companies, executives, and investors behind those plans accordingly. If American journalism doesn't get the climate story right, and soon, no other story will matter. The news media's past climate failures can be redeemed only by an immediate shift to more high-profile, inclusive, and fearless coverage. Our Covering Climate Now project calls on all journalists and news outlets to join the conversation about how to make that happen. As the nation's founders envisioned long ago, the role of a free press is to inform the people and hold the powerful accountable. These days, our collective survival demands nothing less. And that was from The Guardian. Why is the U.S. news media so bad at covering climate change? And as mentioned in the story, you can read the entire story at Columbia Journalism Review. And now, grunge Nirvana rock star Kurt Cobain and USMC Vietnam veteran Lewis Puller Jr. committed suicide 25 years ago. Though they never knew each other, I wrote a dialogue between them when someone said that I couldn't compare the two seemingly opposite personalities. I call it The Poet of Alienation Meets Chesty Jr., A Dialogue in Suicide. And I could start with a quote by Michael Herr, the war correspondent. The war and the music ran power off the same circuit. Rock stars started falling like second lieutenants. And he meant that about Vietnam. The characters: Kurt Cobain, a rock musician, and Lewis Puller Jr., a Vietnam War veteran and writer, sit together at a table in a bar somewhere, nowhere. Who knows why? Who cares? Puller is 48. He has no legs. Parts of his arms are missing, and most of one hand. Cobain is 27. He has all his parts. Puller drinks whiskey, Cobain champagne. Each has a bottle and a glass. The time is just before now. Cobain: Vietnam means nothing to me. I was just a kid when you got blown up. You can suck up all the BS you want from it, but I'm not impressed. I've got my own problems, and they're here and now, not from some old war. Polder, you can't compare my experience with yours. Cobain, why can't I? Your legs are gone, most of your arms, so you think you're the only one who has a right to sympathy? My soul's shot. I don't want to live anymore, so what's the difference? Polder, you magnify your despair. Compared to me, you're in the pink of health. Cobain shakes his head. I'm crippled more than you are. Up here, taps his head. I want to terminate. It's not fun anymore. I want out. Polder, I feel that way too. I used to have a lot to live for. Now nothing. I used to want to be a hero. Now I don't even have the guts to kill myself. Cobain, it don't take guts. You just got to really want to do it. Polder, then why aren't you dead? Cobain, I would be if my wife hadn't interfered a few weeks ago. Man, I was almost there. Champagne and a carload of pills. She found me on the floor and got a doctor. She said I was already blue. That was in Rome, far away from Aberdeen, Washington. That's where I want to be, far away from Aberdeen. Polder, why are you so hot to die? Cobain, suicide's the Cobain family curse. Two of my uncles ate their guns. Not too much functional going on in my family. The usual schizo crap. Drugs, booze, divorce. I used to draw pictures of my parents on the wall and wrote, Dad sucks, Mom sucks. We're all alkies or junkies, and we mess up our marriages. Polder, you're a heroin addict? Cobain, defensively, I'm a junkie because my stomach hurts all the time. Polder holds up his glass in mock salute. I'm an alky because I got no legs. Cobain, I was messed around as a kid. Polder, I wasn't. I loved my father. Cobain, BS. Nobody loves their father. Polder, I was a Marine because my dad, Chesty Puller, was a Marine. People always shook his hand and said they were proud to touch him. He was a great American hero. I felt the only way people would like me was to be a hero like my father. He went through a dozen wars and never got a scratch. He was awarded 5 Navy crosses, a bucket full of silver stars and bronze stars. He was a general when he retired, the most decorated Marine in history. I was a brand new second lieutenant in my first war and got blown to pieces. I should have died. Instead, modern medicine made an extraordinary effort to save me and shamed me into thinking I should help out when all I wanted to do was die. Cobain, music was my way out, the cliché, right? Broken homeboy picks up guitar, starts garage grunge band. I wrote the songs and sang them, grungy stuff. I hate the MTV noise, slick and schlock. My songs are real, but the music got to be the hassle. All those phonies sucking up for money, groupies scamming to be laid so they can tell everybody. We get managers and they move in and say they own me. I like the bucks, but I hate the price. Polder, you don't like it at the top. Cobain, success kills, yeah. Never mind, I don't know what I think. I write songs and sing them. I don't ask for the contracts or other BS. I mean, I want people to hear my music, to appreciate what I put out. I don't want the BS. The bottom line, idiots. The plankton like the two wastes of sperm who raped a girl while singing our song, Polly. Poets don't get famous until they're dead. They're lucky. I'm dead before I'm dead. Number one, and it's all nirvana after that. Yeah, right. Everybody chopping me up like pieces of the true cross. Everybody grabs a piece of me, and they want more. 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 He is quiet. Moody. Stares belligerently at nothing. Gulps of champagne. You know what I said to them? I said, if any of you plankton in any way hate homosexuals, people of different color, or women, please do this one favor for us. Leave us alone. Polder, running a platoon in combat is something like that. I mean, it's different, but it's similar. In that 40 young men depended on me to keep them alive. It's a paradox. On the one hand, I had to be gung-ho and lead them into situations no one who is sane would wish to be, and at the same time keep their precious butts whole and secure, which is impossible. You and I have in common people's expectations. You're supposed to represent a certain generational angst. I was responsible for leading men into sure death and keep them alive. Knocks back a shot. I stepped on a landmine. I wish I had been killed on the spot. I felt as if I had been airborne forever. I had no idea the pink mist that engulfed me was caused by the vaporization of my right and left legs. Doctors told me my survival was a miracle. I drank and thought about suicide. Then I straightened out my act. I did pretty good for a while. I quit drinking. I thought maybe I had overcome my absolute uselessness as a human being. I tried to believe life was worth being alive. I mean, just simply living was what counted, even if half my body was missing. I retained my mind after all. My wife sticks with me. I have very famous friends. Friends try to make me feel I've got something to offer, but even they don't believe it. I'm a cripple. Maybe I'm a famous cripple, an interesting grotesque like Quasimodo, but nobody thinks I've got anything to give them. I'm just a bad memory of the past, which nobody really wants to remember or think about. Pours a shot, throws it back, pours another, does the same. You're an outsider, but I'm an insider ever since I was born. Maybe it's hard for you to be outside, but you've made a career out of it. Me, I'm lost outside. It's not my mind or anything like that that makes me an outsider. It's my broken body, the fact that I'm less than half a man, a tragic misfortune everyone acknowledges, but that's all. I'm dropped from any consideration of being a player. Cobain, irrelevantly. You know, I could have been a serial killer. Artists and serial killers are supposed to share some of the same traits. Broken homes, messed up childhoods, alienation. I'm the poet of alienation, absolutely. But I'm suicidal. The only person I want to kill is me. Puller, are you saying that all that nihilistic despair you sing about is your loss of your father? Cobain, absolutely. Soap opera crap. I ain't got no papa. I hate him because he's gone. I hate everything because he's gone. Eventually commit suicide, like my uncles. Fuller, my father was my hero. I was proud to be his son. I only hated him after I got blown up. He survived a dozen wars without a wound. My first turnout, and I'm disintegrated. I didn't think it was fair. I thought I was payback for his luck. I stopped hating him when I realized my mutilation was actually killing him. I was his fatal wound. Cobain, I've got a daughter. Puller says nothing. Cobain, her name's Frances Bean. Awesome name, yeah? She's 19 months old. I've tried to make sure she knows she's got a dad and that her parents aren't just a couple of junkies. Puller, but you'll leave her. By suicide, I mean. Cobain does not respond. Puller, I hate myself and I want to die. You wrote that song. Cobain. That song made people think I was a pissy, complaining, freaked out schizophrenic who wants to kill himself all the time. They're right. Puller. If you self-destruct, thousands of people will be affected. Your funeral will be as crowded as Rudolph Valentino's and John Lennon's. Maybe a few of your more eccentric fans will copycat you. If I suicide, I might still be allowed a USMC funeral, buried alongside Chesty with a flag given to my wife. For my epitaph, I would like inscribed to the list of names of victims of the Vietnam War, add the name of Lewis Puller. He suffered terrible wounds that never healed. Cobain inserts pills into his mouth and swallows them with champagne. Puller. The obits will call me Chesty Puller, Jr. They might even call me a hero, being blown apart is a heroic act, certainly not the suicide. But whatever else they say, all of them will be sure to say that I'm Chesty Puller's boy. I've lived under his reputation my entire life. Most of the time, I've been proud of it. But when I was in the crotch, the USMC, everybody was curious if I measured up to my old man. Everything I did was compared to him. Whatever I did right, it was because I was Chesty's boy. Nothing of my own ability. My errors indicated I wasn't as good as Chesty. I even felt myself that I would never be as good as my father. 5 Navy crosses. I felt the only way I could measure up to Chesty was get killed. Well, I was killed. Just a few dying cells remaining. Drinks from the whiskey bottle. Cobain offers pills to Puller, who declines. Puller waits for Cobain to say something. Cobain swallows pills, puts down his champagne glass, and drinks from the bottle. Puller, I think you and I might very likely exterminate our miserable lives. Cobain, you hold a shotgun under my chin, and I'll stick a pistol in your ear. Puller, a very long drink from the whiskey bottle. Let's do it. Kurt Cobain committed suicide in early April 1994. Lewis Puller suicided May 11th that year. The Vietnam War ended April 30th, 1975. Today it is 30 years since an old 19th century Astoria house I lived in burned to a charred skeleton on April 25th, 1989. The fire was started by a man who lived upstairs, who was drunk and fell asleep. I wrote a poem about the fire, which was in the Bond Street Historical Slum District, and dedicated to the memory of Coleman Schleiss. Bond Street, farewell. A man, bleak in a dying night, ignites and burns in a chair, in the manner of old Buddhist monks. Unlike gas poured upon flesh to inflame self-immolation, his fuel rapidly evaporating alcohol boiling out through veins and tissue. A cigarette set him afire, small cylinder of menace, which would have got him anyway in slow oxidation, this early spring morning blossoming in spontaneous combustion. His crematorium is an old house in which dwell two elderly ladies who flee his pyre in fear and tears, a brother who shares the attic and flings his mortal life out a window, escaping, unaware of sibling incineration. And in the basement, another man who quit cigarettes a decade before, a monk suddenly awakened and driven from his cell by shouts to get out of hell. A halo of fire crowns his shock as he steps outside his door into the morning before dawn. And that was Bond Street Farewell, which I wrote. And this is Michael McCusker, the monk in the basement. Edward R. Murrow was born today in 1908. He said, "A great many people think they are thinking when they are merely rearranging their prejudices." Happy May Day.
I'm not a clown that can pretend the sun's gone, the heavy light, the day's done, I'm having fun. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy. Happy. Think I'm just happy.